fascinating and insightful look at the law of libel and your personal involvement in it. The last reader is getting from the Belfast Telegraph to say they definitely did not sponsor this lecture. So we'll throw it open to a Q&A. People just indicate. Go ahead, Chuck.
Thanks very much. I'm going to stay away from the label court. Fascinating. Could I ask you one question? When's your book coming out, and will you launch it at this festival without the Belfast Telegraph? We'll ban them.
Well, I'm one step ahead of you. I got the book out last year, which got a news blackout.
That's why I didn't hear about it.
In fact, one newspaper threatened to sue me for libel before he even got it out, and it's a textbook. It's a bit scary, but anyway, we've got it out.
I was looking for memoirs.
Yeah,
you know.
But yeah, no, well, I don't.
I think
I think a board enough. That's more in the law.
Is that
right?
Interruption. Thanks.
Thank you, Paul. That was fascinating. I think it worked out. You spoke for 50 minutes, so I think we all owe you £300 each.
500.
I'm just curious. When you talk about the case, the Forbes case, for example, if he had a lost, would he have been liable for all the other side's legal fees?
Yeah, that's a risk. I mean, and normally the costs follow the events, so he was taking a massive risk, and particularly if you do the multi-jurisdictional, it's three sets of costs doubled up, in theory. In London, I can run cases on a CFA, that's a conditional fee basis, in other words, no win, no fee, but I'm not allowed to do that in Dublin or Belfast. And that's one of the things I've been trying to get changed. I mean, we try to help our clients, you know, but most of my clients, like I say, are journalists, politicians. They can't afford to do it, so we try to use imagination. But, you know, each time I'm having to be very, very careful that I don't step outside Law Society rules. But in London, they allow you to do it that way. And that's one of the differences where people are saying, oh, look, why are we being treated differently from the rest of the UK, having, you know, why we should bring in the English Act so that we are all treated the same. We've always been treated differently. That nobody's cared before that, you know, there's no legal aid for defamation. And here we can't even recover insurance premiums, which I can take out for clients. I can insure them against the risk. In England, that's part of the case. That's part of the damages. If you win the case, you get the premium back. Here, we're not allowed to do that. So, you know, we've always been treated differently.
But in that, for example, what would you estimate the total legal bill was for both sides?
If we had to fight the case and run the case in Belfast and Ireland, I mean, Richard spent $80,000 in New York before he pulled out. I had to drag him out of it. And that was gone. And in New York, you can't cost, don't follow the event. So that would have had to be paid out as damages. And the reason we stopped was the damages in the United States would have been very low, maybe 100,000, maybe 200,000. So the costs would have, you know, been eaten up by the lawyers. Here, we get the costs in addition to the damages. But in the Forbes case, say for the sake of it, we ran it in Belfast and left the other actions in abeyance. You know, he would be running the risk of six-figure sum, maybe, you know, 200,000. He got a substantial six-figure sum in the end, but that would have been a risk he was taking if they could enforce it.
Well, just following off that last point, as you know, I'm a solicitor in Belfast with a practice here. I'm just fascinated about the issue of costs, as you obviously are aware. When legal aid was set up for litigation, the one area which was excluded was defamation cases. Therefore, no matter who you are, if you go to pursue a defamation action, you'll be advised by your solicitor that if you lose this case, the consequences for legal costs will be catastrophic. And that's why I'm fascinated, because you mentioned not just the Hollywood stars, you obviously can afford to take that risk, but the journalists and Barbie punters who just are liable in the newspaper, people who have a mortgage, a house, therefore will have to be advised. If you lose this case, you could end up losing your house. And as you point out, here, unlike in England, we cannot take out some sort of insurance bond. So how does the ordinary punter in the street, who's been mostly liable, get a result?
It's a good point. They have to trust me implicitly. I mean, I don't bill in certain cases. I delay the billing, which I'm allowed to do. I don't have to bill a client at the time. And I trust my own judgment. It's as simple as that. And they've got to trust me that I can win the case for them or I can get a result for them. But it's nothing more than that, and you've hit the nail on the head. It's a major problem here, and the newspapers know this, of course, you know, and this is a difficulty, and they will try and test. So, you know, they'll be very reluctant to take on a BJE suit, because I know he'll keep going and can afford to do that. But, you know, if it's Seamus Collins or whatever, no, of course, no, you can afford to do it too, Seamus, but let's pick another example. But, you know, if it's somebody, you know, Joe Bloggs or whatever, they will deliberately delay, even if it's a case that should be settled, they will delay and delay and delay. But it's just it's just a daily cat and mouse game. I mean, you know, Friday nights when most of my friends have headed off to the pub, I mean, that's when I start to get busy, because that's when all the questions and queries are coming in. So I'm working right through Friday night, Saturday morning, and quite often, I mean, the latest I've managed to hold a mail from the print run was 10 to 10 on a Saturday night. So, you know, you're basically, Friday and Saturday are my two key days. Sunday's tidy up time, where either the client hasn't been warned, or we're doing a, we're having to decide if anything can be done from a PR perspective. But it's a very, very difficult. It's not for widows and orphans, certainly.
Next. This is a young person over there who's thinking of suing someone.
No. He's decided not to be a media lawyer, I suspect. Of
course, are you
represented? They've all got super injunctions, I'm not allowed to say, but I suppose the best known one would be Diego Maradona. And we had a battle for him against what was the News of the World. And I'd say every night for maybe 11 nights, I woke up at 3 in the morning with a cold sweat, and my pyjamas were soaking with the thought of the case going into court, but we got it resolved, luckily, beforehand.
Yeah. Very interesting, your speech, your talk. I read quite recently in the paper that a lot of journalists are very concerned about the law, coming from England over here, but also that the law in England were going to change,
yeah,
where people who didn't have the wherewithal could take a case not just on libel but on accidents.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so there must be a big change coming, or they're trying to.
They're trying to bring it in. In England, there's a change on two fronts. As you say, first of all, they're changing the law in relation to defamation, and that's passed. It hasn't been implemented yet, but it's going to come in September, October. And basically what it means is that there will be no juries and you have to show serious harm. They're also, in tandem with that, and I think that's what you've probably read about, in relation to personal injury cases and defamation cases, they're changing the whole cost structure.
Yeah.
So whereas in London, a lot of the firms were had maybe, say for the sake of argument, they come in on a contingency basis, they would maybe have 100% markup. So if they had an hourly rate of £500 an hour, if they won the case, they were able to double that to £1,000. And they're going to stop that. The maximum you're going to be allowed to do will be 10% markup, which would not encourage any lawyer to do it, certainly in London anyway, if they're expensive to have. And they're extending that to personal injury cases as well. But in theory, it's supposed to make it easier for people to sue, because they will allow the contingency basis in the personal injury case. But the reality is, you've still got to get a lawyer to take it on, and you want a good lawyer. You know, that's the whole thing. And quite often, what sounds okay or what sounds good, I mean, there are situations where, I mean, I would not condone, 100% markup or anything like that there. But what I would want to do would be to have a situation where at least I'm rewarded for taking a risk, because in any case, you know, I may be having to carry maybe £10,000-£20,000 in outlay, because I maybe have to get investigators involved, have to do this and do that. So you need to have something to do a quid pro quo to make it commercially viable, particularly at 58 years of age. You know, I'm not, I wouldn't mind having a glass of Chardonnay on a Friday night like everyone else. But that will be, it'll be interesting to see what happens. I don't really know yet how that's going to develop, but I certainly don't think it's going to improve access to justice.
I mean, the journalist that I had read, I can't remember his name, but he was totally opposed to the change.
Yeah. No, most of the journalists that I act for, you know, have no, they know the forum, and they would have no great desire to see a change. Now, some do, some don't, but it's the newspapers, it's the owners, the publishers are, you know, we're obviously their pockets are at risk, that you don't feel strongly about it. But as I say, you know, it's never been a problem for the Irish News. You know, they will publish as is, and you know, quite often, I mean, you know, I'll get a kicking from them as well sometimes, but if it's something we're doing, then they at least will publish right about it.
Is that
one
again?
The relationship between the press and the celebrity by necessity should be a close one. Is the fracture in that relationship, is it willful, or is it on the part of the press as a result of poor research?
I guess a combination of things. I mean, quite often, I mean, most of the international personalities anyway are very reluctant to sue because they need the press. I mean, as you say, it's the oxygen of publicity is critical for them, and so they will only sue if they absolutely have to. But, you know, for instance, if they're accused of taking drugs, which is a very common one, or in the wrong, or, you know, something like that, there is criminality, they've no choice, because with the internet now, once one rumour like that goes out, it starts to get exaggerated and it's spread around like wildfire. But and they need the press. But because equally because of the internet, because these things are going viral now, they are also having to take action against the newspapers who are publishing online, whether it's a mail or whatever. So that fracturing you're talking about has come about, I think, just because of the consequences now of not doing anything. Whereas 10 years ago, you know, you'd say, well, look, you know, the Sun wrote this about me, but sure, it's over. It was yesterday's news. We can forget about it. You can no longer forget about it with the internet.
Yes, go ahead.
Hi. Obviously, you were talking about Friday night, Saturday being a key period where obviously you're given the right to reply on behalf of your clients before a paper will run a story. Which obviously, in the Lady Walsh case, you had a 4-hour window when you were able to tell them that it was you know, untrue. How then do you work in an environment with the new media, like with the Lord McAlpine people tweeting information where obviously your clients don't have a right to reply? And then obviously, does that have a knock-on implication for damages and taking action? Because obviously, if it's the Mail on Sunday, obviously they have funds, but
yep.
If it's a blogger in a flat somewhere saying something that may well be true, or you know, there may be a shred of truth to it, or it may be totally untrue, but it's caught, you know, it spreads a wildfire rift around the internet, how then, where's the merit in suing somebody? Like, there's no merit
yep.
in suing a man of straw, so how does that change the game?
You've just hit the nail on the head. I mean, that's a very good point, and it's one that really everyone is now starting to struggle with, because, I mean, all this talk about changing the defamation law is academic for the very reason that you've just pointed out. If you have a blogger who doesn't have any money, he doesn't give a toss. You know, it's a bit like Private Eye over the years. I mean, they've got financial protection. It doesn't matter, and people realise that it's not worthwhile financially. You might get a judgment, but it'll be a paper judgment, it'll be fairly worthless. I took action against, and I was just saying to Danny before we come on here, I mean, I took action against a website in Dublin called Nama Wine Lake, and in fairness, it was actually quite a good site, and I had a bit of time for them, and they basically were exposing the deficiencies in the banks and the developers and whatever. But there was one particular client of mine, a former Anglo manager. I mean, it was right down the tree, and it certainly had nothing to do with the disaster that followed, but they said he was one of the Maple 10, which is false. About 5 or 6 other allegations about him, it basically just were totally untrue. So I wrote to him, but the client said, look, he was nervous because anyone, the word Anglo is like the kiss of death at the moment, you know. So he said, look, can you just get them to take it down and just clarify? I don't even care if it's not an apology, but, you know, to do that now, I couldn't let that go. So I did ask for an apology, but he didn't want damages, didn't want cost, didn't want anything, just do it. So I wrote the letter. And the guy behind Nama Wine Lake, like, this only happened to me possibly twice before in my career. They published my letter, and I thought that was being really clever. And the headline, which, you know, you can still get actually there, is, you know, Paul tweets, Johnson tries to muzzle Nama Wine Lake. All I just asked was to correct the thing. So, you know, he did get my back up, and I did come in, you know, moderately hard the next time round. So he closed the site down. So then I've got this army of bloggers. They're still at me, you know. You wake up on a Saturday morning, you know, and you get threatening, you know, death and whatever, and kill him if you need dirt and poultry and do this, all this. Like, you know, what do you do? You know, what is what? But even the second time round, we didn't look for damage. We didn't look for any financial thing at all. And so that's what you're up against. And then the guy, when he closed the site down, he left the stuff up. So that's the last little vindictive move. So that is the whole key problem we've got now. The same, the guys, you know, in the Ryan Giggs case, the super injunction, somebody tweeted his name. So it's out there, so what's the point in having, you know, the courts, what's the point in having a court order? There's nothing you can do about it. And then the problem arises if they tweet the name of a guy that's about to hang himself, if information is put out there, you know, who's going to be worried about having, you know, whatever, the consequence of that? And there's nothing in the new legislation that's going to prevent that. There's an Article 5 that they're still debating in England, and in fact we're just in the consultation process at the moment, but whereby you will be able to write to Google if there's an anonymous poster of offensive material, and Google then will be given 48 hours to go to the poster and say, are you going to stand over this? If you are, we are obliged by law to give your name to the victim's lawyers, and then they can sue you, and that clears Google. If Google don't do that, then they become the target. Now, that's a start, it's something, but we'll probably have less ball. I mean, Facebook, Twitter, Google are all starting to, you know, be a bit more, just a little bit more responsible, but they suit themselves. But I can't see it's a problem that's going to be there. And if a blogger has no money, You know, they don't care. They disappear off. And also, the America is still a safe haven. America and Iceland is where all the ISPs are harboring themselves, so they've got First Amendment protection as well. So I don't know what's going to happen there.
What else? This back.
First of all, thanks for your talk. It's been very enjoyable. To bring you back to the Lady Walsh case, when Ellie said that he was falsely accused, you mentioned that a journalist had driven the guilty party along to make the statement that was totally untrue. Were there any consequences at all for that journalist?
None whatsoever. None whatsoever. And they never admitted it. We knew that that happened. It was adduced in court. And one of the interlocutory applications, but no, it wasn't. And that's one of the things that's actually sickening Louis, you know, the fact that this can be done in this day and age, that this can happen. And, you know, it's a high profile individual. You know, people maybe don't have a lot of sympathy from say, look, you're in the public eye, you know, you're making your money from you know, public support and whatever, but you know, there's nothing really can be done. The case settled. We took a view. We wanted the apology published, and he got the $500,000 that we'd asked for, and that's the way we'd left it.
What else?
What do you think in Louis Walsh's case that guy told lies about what happened?
Sorry?
In Louis Walsh's
yes.
case, what do you think the guy told lies about me?
It's total fruitcake. Absolute fruitcake. And came out of this. But he tried to tell lies, but somebody else were heard, you know, as well. But, you know, he wouldn't have had the platform if the Sun hadn't provided it to him. He wouldn't have had the platform to make, you know, to make the allegation if the Sun hadn't provided it for him, both in terms of the print and, you know, and facilitating it.
Did you get him to write something about me?
Yeah, absolutely.
I work in reputation management and public relations roles, active for quite a few of our clients as a mentor and a counsellor, I have to say, before it ever gets to the more complex stages. But I'd be very interested, Paul, in your views on the anonymity afforded to those accused, particularly with regard to sexual crimes. These are areas that are coming more to the fore, and where there is no anonymity afforded the accused prior to a prosecution being brought.
Yeah.
How and the impact that has on their reputation.
It's a big difficulty. I mean, the key here is the biting point. When should somebody be named? You know, whether it's Rolf Harris or whatever. You know, is it at the point they're questioned by the police? Is it at the point they're arrested by the police? Or is it at the point where they're convicted? And, you know, everyone's got a different view on this. And it's really the litmus test, I suppose, has to be the public interest. You know, if somebody is a paedophile, are suspected of being one, I suppose. I mean, the argument is that the public, you know, have the right to know sooner rather than later. But the question is, if it turns out that he wasn't a paedophile after, you know, a 2-week criminal trial, then, you know, he's been in a situation where he might as well be one because, you know, he'd be maligned. And it's striking the balance between that. I mean, I personally think if the police get to the point where they believe they have enough evidence to charge him, I think that's a point where anonymity goes. But up to that point, I think there should be anonymity, and that would be my viewpoint on it. But again, that's something that's under a major debate at the moment, and I know the government are looking at that option, and I think that's probably what's going to happen, although it may be that they'll do it at the arrest stage, which is earlier again. But,
still on over here.
You were saying that after the Desi Bowe cream buns case, there was a clear out of the editorial board at the Sunday World. I mean, has there been any consequences on other newspapers as a result of, you know, not necessarily, I say, people being arrested or whatever, but in terms of losing their jobs or having, you know,
no, well, certainly, just to give you the example of Walsh, there's been absolutely Dominic Moen was the editor, and the guy Smart, who was our entertainment reporter, they were the two people involved that we were talking to in those hours beforehand. And to my knowledge, there have been no consequences whatsoever for them.
Gerard?
Paul, I really enjoyed your talk today. I came along, I've never heard of you.
That's a good start, actually. That's probably a good thing. That's the best news I've heard today here.
I won't
be getting a phone call from you on a Friday night then.
I would have just like to say, you know, talking about the high profile cases you've dealt with over the years, have you dealt with many low profile cases? I mean, the ordinary Joe Blogs in the street, you know, people that aren't so well known, celebrities, How have you helped those people?
The bulk of my cases are for ordinary people, the bulk of them. Now, I don't know if you call, you know, you would include journalists as in as ordinary people, but, you know, I think you, that would be a one group. I mean, we act for everybody. The frustration I have is that there's only a limit to what we can do for the ordinary man on the street coming into me. I mean, we would, on an average day, would take between 5 and 10 inquiries. Of those 5 and 10 inquiries, 80% would be for ordinary people walking around Wellington Place or wherever. That would be the normal run of it. But of those claims, because of the financial restriction and difficulties, it's got to be a very, very strong case before we can actually take action. In the interest of the client, it's not, you know, a question from our point of view, because from my perspective, I mean, we can normally, there are very few cases we can't get resolved somewhere along the line. I mean, we would, in the last 3 decades in Belfast, there have been no more than 3 cases, libel actions that have actually reached the courts. 3 a decade, 3 in the 1980s, 3 in the 1990s, 3 in the 2000s. So most of the cases don't get there, but of the cases that you hear about that get there, they're either brought by people who can afford to do it or have put everything they have in life on the line. And, you know, that's the way it goes. But sometimes, you know, it can be easier for somebody with no financial assets to have a rattle at it, in the sense that they have less to lose. But the problem is the paper will make it more and more difficult for them by dragging it out, and therefore the resources then are going to be undermined in terms of what he needs to actually get there, and that's a big problem.
Anyone else?
Mm-hmm.
This lady here.
What's your favourite case
you've ever taken on? Favourite case? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, most of them are raw stress. It sounds great afterwards, and you can be quite jolly and say, well, that was great, but the reality is, they're all very stressful, but it has to be the Eastwood case, no doubt about that at all. I mean, I was sort of so heavily involved in that, I regarded that as, like, me personally been on the line in that. And Barney and I had to go out to Vegas, Denver, Los Angeles, New York to get the witnesses in, you know, the former sparring partners, the medical people, the physios, the doctors. And you know, I mean, we Pervis have been through quite a few spats over a 30-year period. But definitely that case wasn't it. And neither he nor I took any great pleasure from winning the case, and I don't know how much Barry McGuigan personally had to pay, if anything. I mean, it was Polygram, who owned Channel 5 Video Distribution, who were the co-defendant, and they were calling the shots in the end. I think that was one of the problems, that there either was an indemnity there or whatever. I don't know. I mean, I'm speculating. But, you know, nobody took any pleasure in winning. But, you know, if Barney had lost that case, both he and I would have had to leave this country, I can tell you now. That was so vicious behind the scenes. So.
I got here late, so I missed the names of the celebrities or Hollywood
before,
so
yeah. Interested
to hear.
You start dropping names, people think you're an absolute prat. But I mean, you know, we've done, I mean, most of them are in the press. If you Google, you know, my name, you know, you'll see. But we've done Will Smith.
Do you ever get to meet them, or are you always acting for them?
No, we meet some. I mean, Liam Neeson would do all his own phone calls and everything himself, for instance. But Britney Spears I've never met. But I had to satisfy myself that she was instructing me. So there'll be lawyers, publicists, management, agents, there's a whole, and it just really depends. But I would meet, you know, quite a few. Kelsey Grammer would do all his own stuff as well. You know, it really depends on the individual whether they, you know, retain management. You could probably guess yourself, you know, who would be doing the direct stuff. You know, the Coors do their own stuff, that they would have been doing the calls, and Colin Farrell. You know, it just really depends on the individual people. But, you know, we've done, I would say, I'm really quite flattered to hear this gentleman here hadn't heard of me here. We've had 82 A-listers from the movie and music business would have come through here, but not all. Most would be Dublin. I mean, because I just prefer to litigate in Dublin. I'm more comfortable with the system there, and that would tend to be the Sindo and you know, whatever would be covering most of those cases.
Even if the English stuff does come in here, you could still litigate in London. You'll still.
When we're litigating in Dublin, yeah. No,
I mean, you'll still raise action in multiple places.
It won't make a hoot of difference to me whatsoever, but it will affect the man in the street. I'll tell you that now. There's absolutely no chance. I mean, this is basically the papers, and when you read the Belfast Telegraph's coverage, remember it's their readership they're hitting, not Paul Tweed. I mean, Dublin, we're basically, 80% of our cases are in Dublin at the moment, 10% London, 10% Belfast, if even that. And in fact, the courts here are sort of a bit, you know, uncomfortable. The fact that the libel actions have virtually dried up, and so I don't. Even if the law doesn't come in, that won't change. It's just it's easier to. It's a far more electorate friendly, as I always like to say, regime in the south than here.
Can I ask a question? Have you ever tripped up and libeled somebody? Who would you get to represent you?
Me. Sorry, couldn't have that one. But
okay, folks. Okay,
thank you very much.
Let's stay in on the rest of the day. There's a lecture, I'd say, in this theatre next door, The Future of the Catholic Church in Ireland. That will be Patsy McGarrett of Lillage Cross from the Irish Times, and Reverend Tim Bartlett, and the chair of it is Pat Coyle, journalist, and who worked for the Jesuits in Dublin. Yep. And that's at 1:30. It's 1:30. It's probably being here actually. And then at I should have brought my glasses with me. Yes, at 2:30 next door. It's First Lady of Controversy. It's Professor Catherine Clinton from Queen's, who'll be giving a talk on the life of Mary Todd, who was a controversial wife of President Abraham Lincoln. That'll be next door. And then at 4 o'clock, we'll be there at 3:30, Scribes at the Rock is on, and that's Holly McLeish, performance poet from England, Michael Harding from the Irish Times, and Peter Sheridan, playwright. That's the 4 o'clock in Scribes. If you meet us around there, you can grab and see what else is on for the rest of the day. The discussions and debates continue until Sunday. Okay, many thanks, and many thanks to Paul.